Hey, this is Spill the Wine, volume, I don't know what number we're on. Anyways, here's a new episode, and I've had some friends come back to me and give me some constructive criticism, which is certainly something I like, because no one's actually ever said anything to me. People say, yeah, I like your podcast. I'm like, oh yeah, does it sound okay? Is my voice? I mean, I can't stand the sound of my voice, but is it okay? No, it sounds great. Everyone's just being casual. So finally, somebody came back to me and said, man, you got to be much louder. You got to be a lot, you got to be picking people up more, and you got to really excite people and get something going on. And I'm thinking, wow, that's not really me. I'm new in front of the microphone. If I just start shouting, all right. I mean, I can try this. Hey, this is Christoph Ellinghaus, and this is my podcast, Spill the Wine. That's not any better, right? That's not fun. Okay, so welcome back to Spill the Wine. My name is still Christoph Ellinghaus, and I'm not going to shout at you much more. But this is the first podcast that's actually about wine. So if you like wine, but you don't know much about it, today is your day. Or this is your hour. I've invited Isabelle Le Giron, Master of Wine, which is the highest status of a sommelier master you can become. It's like the black belt in karate. Or something like that, and it's a real ordeal to get there. But Isabelle is on a mission, and the mission is called Natural Wine. And so this, I've asked all the stupid questions about natural wine that you never dared to ask, because all these natural wine hipsters, these well-groomed, fully bearded, super cool dudes that sneer at you like you just came in an indie store and asked for a Sting CD. So all those people you can now ignore, and you can brush them off, because you'll know so much more about natural wine when you're done with this hour, because it's kind of a crash course. And Isabelle is great. She's in Berlin this weekend for the Raw Wine Fair, which is her own wine fair. She started it. We're talking about all of this in the upcoming chat. So let me not bore you much more. I should be shouting something on my way out. So have a listen to this amazing interview with me and Isabelle Le Giron. I hope I pronounced this right. Am I pronouncing it right? French isn't really, has never been. But she's French and she's great, and she lives in London. That's why her English is exceptional and far superior than mine. And she has the vocabulary down. So let's get into it. Isabelle and me talking about wine on Spill the Wine. Thank you for coming to Berlin to talk about yourself.
It's my pleasure.
Isabelle, I was flipping through the book, which I read a few years ago again when I was preparing, and when I was prepping for this, and I saw that on the cover, this book's called Natural Wine, and then on the cover it says you actually put your MW. So it says Isabelle Le Giron.
MW. Yeah.
Is that something that you people, I want to say, you people do? Is that like a PhD or like a doctorate in wine?
Yeah, it's like that. So, Master of Wine, it's sort of an accolade and it's part of your title, I guess.
And it's the highest It's like the black belt in karate.
Right? It's like the black belt in karate, actually. There's about 350 or 360 at the last count. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, the MW is a very interesting journey. I mean, it's pretty, you know, I would say conventional in that sense. It's a bit like a PhD.
We come to that.
Yeah. It's like a PhD in wine, and you study, you know, everything there is to study about soil and viticulture and vinification and all that. And then when people become an MW, a master of wine, then they put MW after their name, and you know, so do I.
And you have to. Part of that is you really have to know kind of the essence of the soil on pretty much every, in China, where they make wine, right?
You have to have a comprehensive picture in your head as to what's happening worldwide, you know, worldwide, but in the world of, you know, agriculture, well, viticulture, farming, you know, vinification, cloning, the, you know, even legal aspects of wine and, mm-hmm. and so on. So it gives you a really good snapshot as to what's happening in the world of wine today. So it's very interesting, in that sense.
Snapshot. It's under, like that might be a bit of an understatement.
It's not understatement, you know, because I realize, you know, the more I read about wine and the more I study about wine, the more I realize I actually know nothing.
Wow. That from a master of wine.
But I'm sure it must be the same with you in music.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
The more you sort of listen, research, talk to people, the more you realize actually we've tried to put, you know, knowledge into small boxes, but actually, you know, there's so many hectares, many different regions producing wine. How can you even think that you know?
Yeah. In music, it's different. There's just constant renewal because there's always young people coming on the scene, making incredible music. You're like, where's this coming from? Where's that coming from? So there's just constant evolvement. But, I'm doing these interviews and I'm doing this podcast largely because I'm interested in people who take, interesting turns in their life and, some drastic turns, some not so drastic ones, but interesting turns. And so, You just said it. The master of wine education is very conventional, very classic. So I'm assuming you know way more about Bordeaux than you ever wanted to, or that you now think you need. So when did you make the turn? When did you actually turn your back on that sort of very conventional wisdom that comes with that education? And you were like, no, actually, natural wine. That's for me. That's mine.
Yeah. It was a gradual process, actually, to be honest with you, Christoph. You know, I come from a farming background. Mm. I was brought up making jams. We had animals. You can give me a pig and I can butcher it and I can make sausages, pâté.
Really?
You know, really.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, really, really. We really literally made everything. You know, we collected snails, collected, you know, wild herbs to make teas. You know, my family was extremely sort of like, living very, very closely to earth. I mean, you know, partly because it was the 70s, 80s, and actually they had no money. And
whereabouts was this?
In Cognac, in very rural Cognac though, you know, and they had, you know, 12 hectares of vines, a bit of fields, that, you know, came down from my mum's side and my dad's side. So everybody in my family are farmers. So I was brought up, you know, farming. And as a teenage kid, I just thought, stuff this, you know, cause I was like stuck in the vineyards on the Wednesday afternoon of school. On a Saturday, I had to help. Basically, I did the vintages and I was always helping in the winery, bringing in the grapes with my granddad. That was kind of my job. And I just thought, actually, you know, I've got to go to university and I don't want to do this forever. So I left at 18, went to uni, did business, ended up in London, got a job. And within about 3 or 4 years, I really started missing the farm life.
Oh.
So I thought, actually, you know what? I was brought up farming grapes, but I knew nothing about wine. I knew a lot about what to do physically in the vineyard, but I didn't know Chardonnay and Chablis pretty much, you know, were from the same family. I had literally zero knowledge of wine. And I thought, actually, you know what? I'll go back to studying. So I went back and I did the WSET diploma, and then I just thought, well, I'll do the Master of Wine because I didn't know anyone who was a Master of Wine at that time. And I just thought it's got a good way of being part of the community. I just went on to do the MW and passed. But as I progressed in my wine knowledge, And I met more and more people. And I did, you know, and I did loads of jobs, and I was like a, you know, like, I was helping a wine tour company so I could travel and learn more. And, but as I learned more, and I realized actually the more I was learning, the more removed I was from farming, and that actually the world of wine is pretty corporate. You know, it's full of people, you know, dressing up in suits and being all serious and being very intellectual. And actually, I couldn't really relate. It really wasn't speaking to me. And as this was happening, I was also discovering this parallel world, you know, of farmers or people who make tiny productions, who have dirty hands, who also, you know, eat organic and who are like really just exactly like I was brought up. And that, at that, you know, at that moment when I started discovering there was this parallel universe, when I became an MW, because I carried on studying, and like you said, I knew more about Bordeaux that, or blue chip champagne than I would ever want to. And then the minute I became an MW, I just thought, okay, this is it now. And then I dedicated the rest of my career to, you know, these low intervention organic biodynamic and natural wines.
So, what, give me a time frame. When, how long does it take to do this Master of Wine thing? Because it's quite an undertaking, I believe, right?
It's a huge undertaking. I mean, it's, you know, basically, I mean, it took me 4 years. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, I'd done already 2 years in the diploma. So it was 6 years, and I'd already done, you know, a master's and, you know, wow, what's not in business before. And it's,
so what year are we in?
We are in 2008. Mm-hmm. I think 08, 09 anyway. And I started sort of my wine career, I would say in like 2000, 2001. It's a huge undertaking because you have to literally, I mean, it's a lot of work, and it's all self-study. So you have to be pretty determined, particularly when you're working. So it's like very early mornings, very late nights and weekends. And you have to, you know, you have to really taste tons and tons of wines. The Master of Wine, you know, the Master of Wine is a really beautiful thing in that it really helps you think for yourself, and you don't have to, but you know, I'm very unusual. I'm one of the only masters of wine, I would say, who actually really embrace natural wines. Mm-hmm. But I was never stopped from having this kind of creative thinking. You know, mm-hmm. It's just the Master of Wine is all about being able to justify your own opinion and being able to research your own opinions. Like any trade, yeah, you know, it's like, I think you have to be part of the system if you want to try and change the system. Right. So for me, doing the MW is kind of part of that, you know, that journey, which is why I never gave it up, because actually it was giving me a lot, in that sense. But it's true that when you start then, like, you know, when you start working with growers who make wine completely naturally, no one's really researched it, or there's no rule book, or there's no, you know, no one really writes about these wines or used to write about these mm-hmm. wines 10 years ago. So you realize actually you are an MW, and I personally realized actually I knew nothing really about
right,
wine.
Yeah.
And that's when I started really learning about wine properly.
And it was triggered by meeting these people with dirt on their hands and fun in their life.
Yeah, exactly. And then one incident that happened is I had a television program called Journey into Wine. We were scouting, so we did a show in so I was fronting it, and we did a show in South Africa. Then we ended up in Central Eastern Europe, in Hungary and Romania, and
oh, wow,
which was really a lot of fun because we were on the road, basically a team of just three or four of us. But before I did my show in Hungary, I flew there and I tasted about 300 wines, all blind, because I wanted to pick my growers without really knowing who they were. And I heard of this huge lineup. It took a day, and I picked two wines and I said, look, I want to meet these two guys because, or women, but you know, because I think that what they're doing is really unusual and very special. And they were both made by the same grower, Imre Kahlo, who makes 140 different wines in some kind of cave in Eger.
Wow.
And like does skin contact because he does skin contact because he's always done it. You know, he's never really learned about natural and doesn't even know what it is. And when I went to see this guy, and he makes extraordinary wines, he doesn't own a press. He doesn't press. He just like doesn't have pumps. Everything is free run. And just suddenly, you know, I just thought, there it is. You know, you don't need so much equipment. You know, all these bullshit that we've been fed, that you need the latest press and the latest this and the latest this and spend £1 million to refurb your winery and have all the shiny equipment. There's this guy who makes extraordinary wines. And from that moment, you know, things really started to crumble for me, and I started questioning everything. Mm. And then it was just kind of the beginning of a new adventure. Yeah.
He makes 140 different wines.
It's crazy. Every single little barrel or jar is a different wine. Wow. And you go there and you taste about 50 wines through the day. So it's quite an experience. I really recommend it. I think you'd have a blast.
That is
we should
crazy.
Go there, actually. It would be a lot of fun.
So, yeah, I should. So we need to, I think we need, because I don't know if my listeners do know even what skin contact is or what, because, you know, this podcast is called Spill the Wine, but it hasn't really dealt with wine at all. So I was waiting for you.
Okay.
I think we need to go into that a little bit. We need to nerd out a bit more and do a bit of crash causing later. But I just want to get, so that was the beginning. That was the epiphany. You met this guy in Hungary and then you find a wine that touches you in a different way than all the other wines. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, oh, this is speaking to me and this is not.
Yeah.
Just a practical question. When you study for this Master of Wine and you have to know everything about blue chip champagnes, that sounds like a real big investment, though. You have to buy all these expensive wines that you have to know about? Or
I mean, no, you don't. Because, you know, like, I'm living in London. Mm-hmm. I live in London, and we have
makes
literally...
makes it even more expensive.
No, but you have access to everything. You know, they're like hundreds of tastings going on all the time.
Right.
You have access to all this stuff.
Were you working in wine at the time during this education?
No, I wasn't working in wine. I was working in publishing.
Okay.
At the time.
Book publishing.
Yeah, book publishing, magazine publishing. But I also did a lot of jobs on the side, you know.
TV show.
The TV show came with it, and I was running and then I started a wine school. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, I did a lot of teaching. I also did a lot of studio work. For like television, you know, cookery shows. And I was the kind of the resident wine expert throughout all of this. Yeah. So you don't, I mean, it can be an expensive, sort of program to do if you live quite far and you don't necessarily have access to a lot of wines. But otherwise, if you live in a place where the wine world is actually pretty generous in organizing a lot of tastings,
yeah.
You know, for us. So that's,
okay.
That's, they're very manageable.
So then was it as early as 2013 that you published that book? Natural, you wrote a book called Natural Wine. I think it came out in 13 or 14.
13 or 14, yes.
It's kind of a standard reference now, I think. No,
People call it the Blue Bible. Now it's orange because it's the second edition, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's become, in fact, a lot of universities or teaching programs, you use it as a bit
it's
of a background research.
Yeah. It's an amazing book because you go into everything. It was almost too much for me to like digest. Oh wow. Do I really have to learn about chemistry now? But yeah.
It's a book about the living. And I wanted to write because a lot of people are confused about what a natural wine is, mm-hmm. right? So a natural wine is very simply a wine which is made just using grape juice. Now, it sounds like something quite stupid, and that it's an obvious fact to state. And I think a lot of people believe that actually wine is just grape juice. But, you know, most wine produced today has dozens and dozens of additives added to it, mm-hmm. you know. So natural wine is a rarity. It's 0.001%, not even, of the industry is produced naturally. So we're talking about a tiny drop in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, and there was nothing really available as a resource. So I wanted to do something that was really simple, but also quite technical. And you're right, you have to understand a little bit about chemistry, but not hardcore chemistry, but you know, wine is all about fermentation, the way bread is about fermentation, the way chocolate is about fermentation, the way coffee is about fermentation. You know, so actually the beautiful sort of chemistry that happens when you make wine, I think is quite important to understand. And so what I wanted to do is do a celebration and explain very simply what happens in the soil, why organic viticulture is actually so important, mm-hmm. you know, why natural vinification is so important. And then, you know, there's stories about people, you know, there's like a bread recipe in there. There's a story about somebody who distills his own herbs to spray on the vineyards. So the idea was to make it like quite a simple.
No, and it's great. And you shine a light on all the elements that go into growing a plant. And, you know, the normal, when you go and buy a bottle of wine in the supermarket, you don't think about soil or earthworms or, you know, minerals or whatever goes on top of that soil. So it was a very eye-opening, great. And that's what I was saying. Is it sort of like the blue Bible?
Some people call it the blue Bible. Yes.
The blue Bible is like the blue Bible of the movement. Can it be called a movement? Is it a movement?
It's not a movement, you know. I think it's people being more and more aware of something that's always existed. You know, so natural wine. Okay. So we've been making wine for 8,000 years. We've been making natural wine for a long time. You know, when people, you know, whether it's Georgia or China, whoever claims to have the longest history, you know, when they were making wine, they were just using grapes. And somehow along the way, particularly in the last 50, 60 years, we've kind of started, you know, using a lot more additives and very high tech equipment to make wine. But, you know, just forget about wine for a second. Think about any food industry, right? Think about the way milk was produced in the 50s, 60s, 70s even, before we started right. playing with hormones and that. Or think about the way wheat was produced. So wine is exactly part of that same movement. And we are now realizing that, hang on a second, you know, I don't have to necessarily say, yes, I'm going to drink whatever without knowing what's gone into the production process.
And this is the interesting
thing. And that's exactly.
Some of my best friends are vegan. So they really think about what they put in their, what food they put in their mouth. Yet when it comes to drink, they don't think twice.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's because there's been a lot of really brilliant marketing in the world of wine, where wine has always been sold as this product of terroir, as this natural product, you know, these like amazing pictures of rows and farmers and so on. But in fact, it's very far removed. And there's no ingredient labeling law for wine. So when you pick up a bottle of wine in the shop, next time you go around to a shop, pick all the bottles you like, it only gives you the alcohol content and it says contains sulfite, which actually doesn't actually really mean anything because it doesn't tell you how many or how much sulfites is in that bottle. So there's no awareness, basically about how wine is produced. And there's this big mystery or secrecy in the industry where people don't really want to tell you that actually, yes, maybe they use egg or a fish derivative.
For the
fining process. So when you make wine,
that's disgusting. You know,
well, it's a way of speeding up the process. You know, rather than wait for wine to fine itself or settle itself naturally over time, people will accelerate the process and maybe they want to get rid of some of these big harsh tannins or green tannins, or they don't want the wine to be cloudy, so they might fine it to accelerate this kind of clarification process.
Wait, but I'm just seeing a barrel of wine and a winemaker breaking an egg and throwing that into the wine.
Use the egg whites, but yes, yeah, they do. But like in Bordeaux, you know, traditionally they beat up some fresh egg whites.
And then you filter it out, or how does that work?
And then basically you literally, okay, so you know when you want to make some really clear soup, mm-hmm. you might use a protein to precipitate and flocculate all the agents so that you make a very clear
right.
soup, for example. Wine is exactly the same. So you add a protein to flocculate these. So you might add an egg derivative, a milk derivative. Before, you know, they used to use ox blood, for example. Now it's illegal. But what happens is you mix it in, it flocculates, and technically speaking, it falls down to the bottom of the barrel or mm-hmm. the vat. So, you know, people say, well, it doesn't matter. It's not actually an additive. It's just an aid mm-hmm. because it's supposed to be disappearing, but there are still trace elements. So if for political reasons, social reasons, you decide that you don't want to be drinking wine that has been made using an animal protein derivative, you have no way of knowing.
Because so they're you using can't tell. Egg white for this. They're using, I heard something, fish bladder.
Yeah, the fish bladder derivative is called isinglass. And that's actually, you know, quite widespread, particularly in the use of sparkling wine. It's particularly effective to make, to clarify sparkling wines. So very, you know, very likely you will have had in your life a sparkling wine that has been fined with a fish bladder derivative.
And,
for sure.
And bone marrow gelatin type stuff as well.
Yeah, and gelatin.
What's happening with that?
That's another.
Same thing?
Yeah,
that's same another, process?
Same process.
But then the actual filtering is done through, like a coffee filter or something.
Yeah, so it can be, you know, very, so that we were talking about just fining and just trying to basically flocculate the elements. But, you know, you can also fine, filter. So you can filter very gently. So a lot of people do a very, not a lot of people, but like people who make natural wine or low intervention wines, they use a very gross filter literally to remove insects. Mm-hmm. But you can also sterile filter. So you can remove any sign of life. In fact, a lot, you know, wine can be more sterile filtered than your water. So the tightness of the filter is incredible. And that's a way of people are worried there might be, I don't know, it may be a contamination, or maybe if you're trying to make sweet wine, you don't want the yeast to exist anymore. So you filter it really tightly to remove the, any chance of maybe the re-fermentation happening. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can, you know, you can literally, manipulate, you know, wine has just become any other drink. You know, if you want, and if, for example, you have a very rainy vintage and you bring in your grapes and they're very waterlogged, you can use a process through, for example, through reverse osmosis, or where you can literally zap out excess water, mm-hmm. excess alcohol if the vintage was really, really hot that year. But, you know, let's be clear. I don't have a problem with this. I think, you know, people, you know, if you choose to drink, you know, Coca-Cola, then you choose to drink Coca-Cola, but then you know that's what you're drinking. The issue that we have in the wine industry right now is we know very little about what's in that bottle because there's no information. So I think people completely should be making wine exactly the way that they want. But we should just know about it. You know, there should be like a transparency element. There should be ingredient labeling. We should know about the process the way we do with food, very simply. And then it, you know, and then people can choose.
Wow. And is it true that there's a guideline from the EU, right? Like as to what can go into the process of winemaking and what can't?
Yes, of course. I mean, particularly, you know, for example, if you talk about organic winemaking, you know, there will be a list of ingredients.
No, I mean, I'm just not talking about just in general. I think there's like a list of allowances.
A list of ingredients, for example. Yeah, for
and
sure.
And that's a couple of pages long.
Yeah, you look at them and, I mean, I have no idea what they are, but there's like, you know, anti-foaming agent, for example. You know, when you pump your wine from one vat to another, you don't want it to foam too quickly, so you put this anti-foaming agent so that you can fill up your other vat as quickly as possible. You know, it's all, but the thing is, you know, I don't think people should be surprised. You know, we're in a world where we're trying to do things as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible. Mm. And wine has just fallen in that, you know, in that kind of category.
Yeah, industrialization, obviously. It's a business.
Exactly.
It's a huge business.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah. So just let's get some more of these terminologies sorted. A lot of people think orange wine is natural wine, is the same as natural wine, but it isn't. Orange wine is simply skin contacted wine, a white wine made like red wine. Is it necessarily a necessity to make orange wine to farm organically or biodynamically?
No, I mean, look, there's no definition as to what an orange wine is, mm-hmm. really. You know, so people use the term orange wine even if they have done a maceration of 2 days or 3 days or 2 months or 6 months. You know, an orange wine is basically a white wine made like a red wine. Okay. And to be honest.
So that means, I know what it means, but maybe you can
explain. So what it means is very simply. So if you picture, you know, when you bring in your grapes into your winery, if you decide to make red wine, you might crush your grapes or not, you know, but you bring in your red berries And in order to extract the color out of the skin, which is mainly, the color is mainly located on the, on the skin of the grape, then you do like a maceration, like you do in cooking. So you macerate, you know, your grape juice, your skins for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Some people do it for longer. And then that's how you extract the color. With white wine.
I don't think that's still clear. Maceration like you do in cooking. I've never cooked anything for 3 weeks.
No, but sometimes you macerate your chicken before putting it on the barbecue for like a couple of hours in the juices or something.
Or like a marinade.
Like a marinade, yes.
Okay.
So you marinate your red berries.
So you marinate the berries in their own juice.
In their own juice, yes.
And so the liquid gets, hence the word skin contact.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And you know, typically you would do this throughout the, what you call the alcoholic fermentation. So what, you know, whilst all the sugars gets converted into alcohol, you would leave your berries in contact in their own juices. And that's very easy to understand for the red winemaking process. But
and
typically.
But that extracts tannins.
It extracts tannins, colors, certain aromatic compounds, obviously.
And white wine is not made like that.
So white wine, well, now it's not made like this. Mm. So currently white wine, broadly speaking, you bring in your grapes in your winery and then you just press
The liquid out
of the skins, and then this juice, which is all by itself, the must, you call it, then you put that in a barrel or in a stainless steel vat, and then you let it ferment without the skin.
Mm.
Okay? But increasingly, people are now doing what I call skin contact or orange winemaking, where they're bringing in the white grapes. Very often, you know, they're just getting rid of all the stems. Right. And then they're leaving the berry in contact with the juices for, I don't know, it could be 2 days, 3 days. I would say most likely a couple of weeks. And what you do is you extract the tannins very much like you do with red wine. So at the end, you have a tannic white wine. You also extract very different aromatic compounds that tend to range, you know, towards the, you know, the dried herbs, orange peel. So you create a very different aromatic profile.
Oh, yeah. That stuff needs a whole different vocabulary.
Yes, that's true.
Just to explain again, I'm thinking, whoever listens to this, I'm just thinking total wine amateurs. And I find this interesting. So the tannic expression of the wine, you notice, is like that. That's like that dry feel in your mouth. Correct?
Yes, it's basically exactly, you know, when you drink very strong black tea, you're left with an astringency in your mouth. So basically it's a reaction between the tannin and your saliva creates this dryness sensation, this dry sensation.
Yes.
That's what tannins are.
And what strong to young red wines give you too when the tannins aren't really bound into them yet.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, you know, young red wines also can take their tannins from the oak barrels in which they've been maturing. So you've also got
more of a vanilla kind of.
Okay, let's not even go there. Fine. But you know, the interesting thing about orange wine is that if we go back to your 8,000 years ago, actually, this is how white wine used to be made. And when.
In Georgia
or wherever, people would have been, you know, using, you know, all the skins, and
it
makes sense.
Whole cluster. Sorry for interrupting you all the time, but then you can add the whole whole stems.
Yeah,
they put everything into their amphoras,
including the cha-cha, as they call it, which is the stems, basically.
And then they just wait.
And then they just wait, typically until March, until everything settles down to the bottom of the quarry or. Mm-hmm. You know, wherever you are, and then they drain off the clear juice, and then they clean the amphora, and then they typically put the juice back in.
I always wonder, do they actually dig a hole and get the amphora out of the ground, or do they just pump it with a tube?
Yeah,
or something?
You just pump it out. Yeah,
like stealing gasoline.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Your little DIY job. But you know, to get back to your question, an orange wine is not necessarily a natural wine. You know, an orange wine. All it means is that you have had a white wine made like a red wine.
Okay. That's good because people seem to mix those two things up all the time.
I agree.
And then you wrote this book and then you started a wine fair. So you're you're on a mission. You're an activist. So you started a gathering of I guess, what is your favorite winemakers in London? What was the first year?
That was in 2012.
Oh, that was before.
Yeah, that was before. Yeah, right. And 2 years in, then I wrote my book. But yeah, I started something called Raw Wine, mm-hmm. In London, like you say, initially. And the idea was we didn't really have this in the UK. So I wanted to have a place where, you know, all the growers would come together under one roof, where they could meet the trade, you know, the importers, the sommeliers, the restaurateurs, but also the members of the public. Because I think there's this big divide where actually, if you are the person who is actually buying the wine, you don't really come into contact with the person who's actually making the wine. So I wanted to create this big event of growers who all farm organically, who all make their wines, you know, where the fermentation starts all by itself, so naturally fermented, very low levels of sulfites, if anything. So basically, without adding anything apart from a little bit of sulfites, right? These are the criteria to, mm-hmm. to be part of the fair. And then very quickly, you know, it grew and then we came to Berlin.
We went to Vienna.
Yeah.
For a good reason. Austria is so much advanced in comparison to Germany. Like yes. In terms of winemaking.
In terms of production.
It's explosive. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's tons of amazing growers there. So we did one event in Vienna. And then, you know, we realized actually maybe Vienna was maybe too small or conservative or
remote.
Well, I'll leave you to comment on that.
No, it's beautiful. I love Vienna.
And then we came to Berlin. And then we started organizing the event in New York, Los Angeles. And, you know, and we've got a few more.
Oh, yeah. Where would you go? Japan. I was just in Japan and they have everything.
Yes.
Everything you can't find here.
Is there.
They have.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the biggest market.
Yeah.
And they've always been the biggest market, actually, really interestingly. Mm. So, you know, the idea behind Raw is, you know, we talked a lot about earlier about, you know, this lack of ingredient labeling. And I wanted to create an event that championed transparency. So at the fair, I publish all the information, all the technical information about every single wine. And like in Berlin, in a week's time, we're talking about 1,000 wines, right? We get the analysis. We know exactly how many sulfites are in the bottle. We publish that. It's mm-hmm. on the website. It's in the fair catalog. And I want to start that conversation. I want people to be very inquisitive. I want people to ask questions. So if we're really transparent, and we don't have a lot to be transparent about because people don't really add anything apart from, you know, a bit of sulfites. But if we are transparent, then maybe we can, inspire people to ask questions and ask for more transparency.
And in the beauty of this gathering and of meeting these people, I think is that, if it's not too busy, if your wine fair isn't too successful, we'll see that. But, I know I've been to some that were insanely busy mm-hmm. and you want to have the time to talk to these winemakers because that's the interesting bit. They have a philosophy and they have an idea and they know how to transport that well. If they speak, I don't speak French, but if they speak English or German. And that's what I like about, you know, you talk to these people and they don't just rattle off the soil and the farming method and this and that. You actually, if you get the time with them, it's beautiful. So the original idea is great, but when you have to elbow yourself through to the headline winemaker, whoever has the biggest, bulk of people in front of them. Sometimes it's tough.
Yeah.
But it's good. I recommend it highly. I mean, these fairs are great. So they're successful, right? It's a runaway success. You're going global.
We are global. We are a very small company going global. Yes. I mean, look, it grew completely. If back in 2012, if I was to see how things were today and knowing that actually, you know, it really was going to take off like that. I might have been a bit scared to do it. You know, initially it was just a one-off, you know, 2012, London, let's just see how it goes. And then in London, we had people who flew from all over and we have people who fly from all over. And, you know, I was looking at the list of people, you know, we've got tons of people coming from Russia, from Denmark, from the States. You know, it's a real date in the calendar and people travel to meet those growers because, like you say, they have such an amazing story to tell. And I think that's the thing to focus on. Like you say, it's not about the technical information or it's not about, you know, rolling off the vintage or something, but it's about sharing a philosophy of life and an outlook. It's about sharing, you know, this caring, for the environment, caring for that piece of land that they have. And that's, to me, that's what's the most important. And that, you know, that's what touches me the most. And, you know, sometimes it's really, well, you know, you're on your own business. Sometimes it's tough, you know, to kind of be motivated and, you know, people, the more successful you get, you know, the more shit you get from other people. It always happens like this. And then I just need to pause for a moment and think about the work they do in the vineyard, you know, how they're actually preserving that patch of life. And that's what we have to fight for. You know, we are obviously in this big global mess, you know, where actually the environment is more and more important, but yet less and less important.
Under attack. the environment is under attack in a big way. And I think these people try to make a difference, even in the microcosms they might live in. I want to ask you, wine seems to be a very emotional thing, because I have not seen anything more polarizing than this, the coming out of the natural wine world and coming on into its own. And as you said, most of your MW colleagues are critical of this whole natural wine thing, to the degree where I hear the common narrative on natural wine from classically trained sommeliers is kind of like, yeah, 8 out of 10 are faulty or bad or terrible or something. There's just, it's not like 8 out of 10 conventional wines aren't like horrible. But that argument is always, they don't taste good or something. So the classically, there's a polarization going on that's just so immense. And I wonder if you know why that is, or if you have an idea why that is. Is it because wine is such an emotional thing? Is so, I don't know. Have you thought about this? Why?
Yeah, of
course. You must get a lot of flack.
Of course. Oh my goodness. I mean, to be honest, I've kind of stopped listening to it, because before I used to pay attention to everything that was being said, and you know, you don't get anywhere. You know, you have to kind of look ahead and move forward and focus on the positive side of the stories and, you know, the great work that these growers are doing. But I think for me, you know, yes, wine is very emotional, but paradoxically, it's also incredibly intellectual. And I think in a way, it's become too intellectualized. So we are in this world now, you know, where, you know, it's all about scoring and ratings, and people buy wines because it's 90 plus out of 100.
Oh, right.
People are very driven by actually what it means to own this bottle of wine. You know, wine has become a status symbol. Mm. And I think people now think with their heads. People don't really taste wine with their eyes or their stomach anymore. You know, you have this bottle in front of you, you recognize the label, in your head you already know what it's going to taste like. This way of tasting wine and this fixed idea of, let's take Sauvignon Blanc, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what a Sauvignon Blanc actually sort of tastes like. You know, people in their heads, they have this really bright, almost greenish looking wine, very aromatic, quite tropical. You know, all these kind of like stereotypical, you know, images in your head. But actually most people think that's what a Sauvignon should taste like. But that's because a lot of it is the winemaking process, aromatic yeast. You know, it's a constructed wine, right? And then on the other hand, you give them a Sauvignon Blanc made completely naturally, no aromatic yeast.
From Muster,
from Riffaut, from like, you know, tons of really great growers.
Yes.
And you have something which is actually not that aromatic, which actually is pretty full on, looks golden, looks completely different. And, but rather than embracing all these types of Sauvignon Blanc and these expressions depending on the winemaking, people are like, well, this is not a Sauvignon Blanc. You know, this doesn't taste like a Sauvignon Blanc.
Right.
So I think then there's this thing of like, well, you're giving me this in my glass, but you know, I've been tasting this Sauvignon Blanc. I know what Sauvignon Blanc tastes like. But Sauvignon Blanc, the way people taste, which is like this very modern, technologically made wine, is only, what, a few decades old?
Mm-hmm.
And we've been making wine for 8,000 years. So I think it's worth thinking and putting everything back into context and not being dominated by this very modern expression of certain wines. Because actually, you know, it's a tiny blip in the history of winemaking. And I think the key for me is just to be open-minded and embrace all the various, you know, and remember this, the difference between a cloudy wine and a clear wine is a filter.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So you're in Germany. Did you ever develop a passion for Riesling?
I'm rediscovering Riesling now, you know, with likes of Trossen and, you know, people who work naturally. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to get too much into that sort of, you know, what is the terroir expression of a German Riesling that has never completed its full mallow and things like this, you know. Sorry, you know, let's not get too technical, but I love Riesling, but I really love, you know, the fully natural expression of Riesling with very little sulfites, with, you know, made, you know, sort of by itself and hands off. Yeah, I think it's a beautiful grape. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it is still far too technically made, in my opinion.
Possibly. I can't get away. I love the natural wines, but if you give me a really good bottle of aged Große Gewächsriesling from, I'll probably have that too. But I don't have to feel guilty about it. I love it. So, this is interesting. There were some questions, some more crash course questions here. Second Malo. What?
I know. I'm sorry. I can't help it. When you make wine, you know, you go through a first sort of alcoholic fermentation where, you know, the yeast converts the sugar into alcohol. Mm-hmm. And then there's another sort of like transformation, which is a bacterial transformation, actually, which is where the malic acid gets transformed into a lactic acid. So, you know, the grape juice is very naturally rich in malic acid, but it's quite a harsh green acid. And if you know, for white wine, you know, people sometimes block the malolactic fermentation because
with sulfites
or sterile filtration, cold stabilization. Okay. You know, basically you stop the development and people do this actually a lot in Champagne, for example, where they will want, or sparkling wine production, where they want to retain this kind of quite green mm-hmm. type of acid.
What's the idea behind stopping the second Malo?
It's to preserve, you know, that sort of like, some people like the freshness or the acidic profile, I guess it gives the wine, mm-hmm. Giving this sort of, I don't know, freshness or, you know.
So what do you think is the benefits of having the second Malo?
Well, for me, it's, you know, some wines won't go through Malo depending on, you know, depending on where they're from, if the acidity level is actually incredibly high. But for me, going through malolactic fermentation is like going through puberty. You know, it's a stabilization process. It's sort of, the wine has this alcoholic fermentation and it has this malolactic fermentation, which softens the wines, which means that the wine tend to have a much broader mouthfeel, creamier mouthfeel. And to me, bring actually a stability. So if you want to work without any sulfites, the wine will go through malolactic fermentation. But, you know, interestingly, people, you know, red wine making encourages sort of in a way malolactic fermentation. But in some white wine production, some people like to hold it back.
So we talked about all the additives that are permitted by whoever looks over winemaking. I want to ask one more basic question, not so much for me, but for maybe others out there. There are two types of yeast you can employ in making wine. There's the indigenous yeasts that come with the grapes. They come from the vineyards. They sort of live in your cell, in some of the cellars. And then there's industrial yeast in big paper bags. And that's like laboratory designed yeast strings. Both of these are meant to trigger the fermentation, but both activate entirely different processes. Can you explain that a bit in two sentences?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you bring in your grape juice, providing, I think, you know, by and large that you're farming organically and actually your juice is, you know, really rich in, you know, and biodiverse and have, you know, the natural sort of, you know, yeast population there. The juice will start fermenting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a whole family of yeasts that sort of start the fermentation process. Or so they take it in turns to sort of, you know, do a bit of the fermentation, then another family of yeast will take over the fermentation, will carried on and so on until the wine is fermented to dryness. But that's the same as, you know, when you make cider, you know, you bring in your apple juice and actually they can start fermenting by themselves. So, you know, there's this cells are, you know, in a way magical. And when you make your sourdough bread, it's a very, very, very similar process.
So why use industrial yeast?
So when you add, you know, like you say, lab bred yeasts, or, you know, basically, you've isolated certain strains of yeast that mm-hmm. you've decided that you want to work with. It gives people a lot more control. So when you bring in your juice, first of all, you have to make sure, so you have to knock the natural yeast population with sulfites, mm-hmm. and then you can inoculate. With your own strain of yeast that some people develop themselves, or you can buy from a company. And what that does is it really controls the fermentation process. So you can control how quickly the fermentation process is, what maybe certain elements the fermentation process can, what aromatic components maybe can be a bit more.
You can design the wine, right?
You have a lot more control in terms of what happens to your final product.
Mm.
So, you know, my argument, I would say, is that, you know, the natural yeast population, whether it's in your cellar, in your, you know, like in your winery or on your grapes, on your soil, is part of terroir. And every year, the yeast population is very different.
Mm-hmm.
So every year brings its own set of terroir. And, you know, when you let the wine ferment, you have, if you were to look under a microscope, all the yeasts are very different and it's like a vast population of people having a conversation. If you look at a fermenting juice with, you know, an added yeast population, they're all the same individual. So they bring very similar elements. And I think, you know, for me, it's very interesting to use the natural yeast population because you get a more diverse profile, at the end. And of course, less control. So, you know, sometimes people have fermentations that can go on for months
mm-hmm.
and they're like, it's driving them crazy because it's going way too long, but that's just the course of nature. Whereas if you add yeast, you know, you really control that and you can actually say, okay, well, I want my fermentation to be finished in a week or 2 weeks. And so you have more. You have more control. It's a different path.
Okay, thank you. One last technical question, because I love pet nut. I know I love the whole. I just love everything about a good made, a well made pet nut is such a beautiful summer drink. So I pour it for people, and people go, "Oh, what is this?" And then I try to explain, you know, méthode ancestrale. It's you know, like they used to make it, but I can never find the right words. Can you quickly say the difference between a regular sparkling wine and a pet nut?
So, yeah, I guess that, you know, the main family people understand is the traditional method. Mm-hmm. So the way that a cava is made or mm-hmm. the way that a champagne is made.
Zecht.
Or zecht, exactly. Yeah. So in that process, what you do is you have your juice and you ferment your juice to dryness.
Mm-hmm.
So you make a wine. It's called your base wine. And then you put it in a bottle and then you add sugar and yeast, and you do a re-fermentation in the bottle where the yeast will consume
But that's
the yeast.
Not natural winemaking anymore. When you know, I thought that the concept is add non, take non.
Well, but that's,
you're adding. So yeah. Where's the yeast and the sugar coming from?
Well, but that's the debate. I mean, to be honest, in champagne or in other traditional sparkling producing methods, some people add fresh must. For example, so they might collect fresh must
to re-trigger
the fermentation. Okay, but the traditional method is you produce your base wine and then you put it in a bottle and then you try and trigger a second fermentation where the fermentation is trapped and in the bottle and creates CO2.
Right.
Exactly, which dissolves and the pressure builds. When you make a pet nut or the ancestral method, it's actually really one continuous fermentation. So what you do is in your cellar, you have your fermentation process that starts. So your yeasts are consuming the sugar and they're producing alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at some stage, when you measure actually exactly how much sugar is left, so it's actually quite a technical, difficult thing to make a good pet nut, you bottle that. And the key is to make sure that, you know, which is not always the case, is that the fermentation then either carries on or maybe stops and then carries on afterwards. And that remaining natural sugar that was in the must then is consumed by the yeast that were bottled at the same time when you put that juice, you know, in your bottle. So it's one continuous fermentation that carries on in the bottle. That's a pet nut.
Yeah. And then sometimes most of them are cloudy and sometimes it's quite clear.
Yeah. And some people do dégorgement. So basically, what some people do, and actually, to be honest, a lot of people do that now in the pet nuts, is because when your yeast is consuming the sugar, as it does that, it dies and create these lees, which are dead yeast cells. Mm-hmm. And when that you know, that process is mostly finished, people will get rid of, you know, they will do a bit of riddling and they'll get rid of that sediment through a process called the disgorgement process. But some people choose not to do it. Yeah. So it really, really depends, you know, on the preference.
Right. Thank you. That's the educational hour with Isabelle. thanks for coming on, and good luck with the fair in Berlin. What's the next one after that?
After that is New York. On the first Sunday, Monday of November, and the following weekend, we're in Los Angeles.
Right. Oh, yeah, you're setting the whole country on fire.
I know.
Raw wine week across the...
So you'll come to L.A.?
I've been to New York. I have to be in L.A. every once in a while. That's good. Good idea. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So there you have it. Natural wine, pet nut, second Merlot, the whole lot. Yeast, laboratory yeast, indigenous yeast. Send me an email if you have more questions. Oh, no. Actually, go out, get the book, Isabelle Le Geron, Natural Wine. It's called Natural Wine. The first edition is, as she says, in blue, and the second one, which is a bit more because she's actually going and talking about growers and recommends wines and goes into that stuff. It is a fascinating book. It's so eye-opening and it's really interesting. It's not at all dry or like a chemistry class in school. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's super cool. So there you have it. That was Spill the Wine this week. You now know the difference between natural wine and orange wine, and you never ever have to mix those two up again. How great is that? Educational Hour with me, Christoph Ellinghaus, signing out. Come back next time when, I don't know, we'll talk about something else. All right, bye-bye.